This is episode 32 of the Time Talks podcast, part of the Channel Zero Network. This month, I had the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Gerald Horn, the renowned historian and scholar who is a professor at the University of Houston, author of more than 30 books. Most recently, he released The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. In this episode, we mostly discuss his other book he released this year, The Dawning of the Apocalypse: The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. In this episode, Dr. Horn discusses the Crusades, the transition from religion to race that led to the project of whiteness, to class collaboration between settler colonists, to rebellions by enslaved peoples, and internationalism. Thank you to Awareness for the music, and here's a brief jingle by a fellow Channel Zero Network member.
Listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 p.m. GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more.
Actually digs into your history, and I was wondering if you could describe a pivotal moment in your history or a transformative experience that helped you see through the propaganda of U.S. history and settler hegemony and made you question what was being taught in your K-12 education and dominant culture as a whole.
Well, it's difficult to point to one moment. I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri during the era of Jim Crow. And certainly from an early age, it became very difficult to accept the mythology of the United States as a shining city on the hill and this epicenter of democracy when you can't go into certain restaurants that are treated like a third-class citizen. I mean, you don't have to be a genius or an oracle to begin to suspect that there's something awry. So I would say that growing up under those conditions, that was pivotal in terms of my own evolution as a scholar and a thinker.
Now, I remember in one of your works, you had spoken about one of the political leaders of India who came and was persecuted in the South. You had also compared that to Angela Davis having to notify people she spoke French or something like that and to combat this Jim Crow South.
Well, that point was speaking to how the rulers of the United States, they tend to have a particular animosity towards the descendants of mainland enslaved Africans. They have an animosity, of course, towards Black people who have roots in the Caribbean and Africa, but they have a heightened animosity, at least historically. It'll be interesting to suggest whether or not there's been an evolution since Jim Crow began to retreat. But certainly during the heyday of Jim Crow, that was the case. And so when Angela Davis in Birmingham, Alabama, was seeking to escape Jim Crow by speaking French, she was reflecting what I'm referring to, because that meant that she was not a descendant of a mainland enslaved Africans. Now, today, with the erosion of Jim Crow and the concomitant heightening of anti-immigrant hysteria, it's not clear if that old trope still persists. And I think that's one of the reasons why we at least some of us study history. It's because things change, things evolve. And that's something everybody acknowledges that in the abstract. You know the song, Everything Must Change? But when it comes to the concrete, people sometimes have difficulty in understanding that things do change and that things evolve. And that may be an example of what I'm referring to.
Now, going way back and talking about this evolution through colonialism and whiteness, as you write about in your phenomenal work, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, you speak of the conversion from religion to race that mm-hmm. foments whiteness under class collaboration. Mm-hmm. And I really see this embodied in the long project of the Doctrine of Discovery papal bull that sent over the genocider Columbus. And then this Doctrine of Discovery became the legal precedent in Johnson versus McIntosh in 1823, which mm-hmm. went into Supreme Court ruling, which was further cited by the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the City of Sherrill versus Oneida Indian Nation of New York, where she actually used the Doctrine of Discovery in her ruling.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to know if you could, or if you could speak about the far reaches of this precedent. And in your book, you talk about the 1551 decree by Charles V of separating races, and really just this long history and legacy of white supremacy and how it really pans out with these precedents today.
Well, with regard to the book itself, in some ways, the starting point of the book, at least in the loose sense, not in the rigid sense, is about 1,300 years ago with the rise of Islam, which takes off like a rocket. And by 1095, you have Western European Christendom that's uniting in what's called the Crusades to reclaim the area they call the Holy Land from what they consider to be Muslim domination. And therein, I suggest, you begin to see the roots of what emerges as whiteness. That is to say, it's originally grounded not necessarily in the concept of race, but in religion, and with Christian versus Muslim. A further step along this rocky road takes place in 1453 when the Ottoman Turks, who are predominantly Sunni Muslim, oust the Christians from Constantinople, today's Istanbul, which injects and induces existential fear in Western European Christendom. They suspected that the Vatican, now cited in what we call Italy, would be next. And that further unites them and further helps to underscore the roots of this phenomenon that we refer to as whiteness. And indeed, it's in 1492, a pivotal year in world history, when not only are the Muslims, or Muslims, I should say, ousted from their final place of rule of the Iberian Peninsula, speaking of Spain, this is after a real fear that Muslims would take over a good deal of Western Europe, just like they had taken over Constantinople. And ultimately, of course, Muslim people altogether were expelled from Spain as a people, each and every one, it was thought, by 100 years later in the early 1600s. But 1492 also marks the acceleration of the Inquisition, whereby sharper lines are drawn, shall we say, between Catholics and non-Catholics, which particularly hits the Jewish population very hard and very rigorously. Many of them are expelled. And of course, 1492 also marks Columbus sailing the ocean blue. And perhaps not surprisingly, it's suspected that there were escaping Jewish folk on the ships that Columbus was sailing across the Atlantic, although many of them wound up in Ottoman Turkey. Many of them wound up in North Africa. Many of them wound up in what we would call the Netherlands. And of course, many of them wound up in London, which is curious because London had expelled this Jewish population by 1291. And I'll explain in a moment or two why London would absorb and accept a Jewish population after they've expelled their own Jewish population 200 years before Spain did. So therefore, 1492, you see Columbus sailing across the Atlantic. And what's interesting, of course, is that they begin to expropriate the indigenous population of the Americas, inflicting a bloody genocide upon them. You also begin to see the beginnings of an African slave trade, although, of course, there's also enslavement of the indigenous population as well, in addition to liquidating them. But another turning point comes in 1517 with the rise of Martin Luther and the Protestant secession from the Catholic Church. Martin Luther and those who followed him thought that the Catholics were corrupt for reasons that need not detain us here in terms of describing why they thought that way. And the Protestant faith spread like wildfire throughout Europe by the 1530s. It had become the state religion in London, and that's still the case to a certain degree today. I'm sure you know the story about Henry VIII and how he wanted a divorce, how he couldn't even get a divorce because he was a Catholic. And I won't dispute that story, although I will add that when Henry VIII seceded from the Catholic Church, it allowed him to expropriate a good deal of Catholic property. And also, it, of course, allowed him to get a divorce as well. And with the secession of London from the Catholic Church, it ignites these religious wars between Catholics and Protestants throughout the 1500s, throughout the 16th century. And to make a long story short, and to give you opportunity to inject your own intelligence, what happens is that Spain has religion as a qualifier for settlement. As late as the 19th century, you had when Stephen F. Austin and his comrades wanted to settle in what is now Texas or Tejas. About 200 years ago, they had to profess Catholicism, whereas London, the scrappy underdog, when it began to try to challenge Spain for the right to claim the territory of the indigenous population in the Americas, they moved away from religion as a qualifier to race, which gets me back to why they began to absorb the Jewish population after expelling them in 1291. In other words, they drew sharp lines of demarcation between those who were of European ancestry and those who were not of European ancestry. And on the other side of that line, of course, were the indigenous population and the Africans. Whereas the Spanish, for example, they would allow for black conquistadors if they professed Catholicism. Historically, you had a substantial free Negro population in Spanish Cuba, for example, who had their own military brigades, for example, as early as the 1500s. This was not necessarily the case, to put it mildly, in the English settlements, as they drew a sharper line of demarcation between the blacks and those defined as white. And therein, you begin to see the roots of our dilemma in the revolting spawn of London, speaking of today's United States of America, because settler colonialism, the system under which we are still laboring, which involved initially English and those they had been warring with, meaning Irish and Scots, crossing the Atlantic, magically rebranding themselves as white once they land on these shores, and beginning to seize the land of the Native Americans. Settler colonialism, that system, involves class collaboration. That is to say that it involves collaboration between wealthy Europeans and non-wealthy Europeans, with the non-wealthy being the foot soldiers, and the non-wealthy feeling that if they go along with the program, they can become wealthy, which may help to explain, for example, the U.S. Civil War, 1861 to 1865, when the Confederate States of the South sought to leave the United States because they wanted to preserve African slavery, enslavement of Africans forevermore, their army was overwhelmingly and disproportionately comprised of non-slave owners. So there was class collaboration between slave owners who were at the wheel of the locomotive and those defined as white who were non-slave owners. But the latter thought that if they went along with the program, they could become slave owners too, which made the project worthwhile. And then in 2020, and a phenomenon that I'm afraid to say many of our friends on the left still, they can't believe it's happening. You have 73, 74 million people, mostly defined as, quote, white, unquote, mostly not of the 1%. It's mathematically impossible, if not imprecise, for 70 million people, shall we say, to be part of the 1% in a nation of 330 million. The numbers don't add up. And I think you can't understand that phenomenon unless you understand class collaboration and settler colonialism. Or to use another example that I've started to use of late, in 1991, David Duke in Louisiana, a Nazi, won 55% of the Euro-American vote in a race for governor. Now, the sardonic and bitter joke that I tell is that when our friends on the left try to comprehend that phenomenon, they'll say something like, well, the voters, they saw that he was a member of the National Socialist Party, so they thought he was a socialist. That's why they voted for David Duke. Well, you know, the joke may be on me, because I'm afraid to say that, you know, this attempt to rationalize the strength of the ultra-right in the United States ultimately is going to have people like myself, although me not exclusively, of course, as the ultimate victim.
Mm-hmm. That's an extreme example of cognitive dissonance, for to say it mildly. You brought up so much here. When you were talking about how the Jewish community was expelled from England in the 1291, going back to this project of whiteness, you said that they were in some circles referred to as new Christians.
Or that's
rebranded.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. And then to kind of hone this talk of genealogy of, quote, whiteness, is you really take, so one work I had read long ago was Theodore Allen. And he kind of stopped at legislation in Virginia being where whiteness kind of started. It's not exactly what he said, but it's kind of the basis of where his book was. And you eloquently write how the history of Virginia and New England, which wrongly deems either or both to be the seedbed of settler colonialism in what is now the United States, and in the long run, the United States has to be abridged with this point firmly in mind. So when you're breaking this open more and tracing this, you had also mentioned that this embryo whiteness was seen with Queen Isabel, who was said to have English blood in her veins.
And
you had also spoke of Lepanto fever, of the great naval battle. You spoke about Italian colonialism inspired Iberian colonialism, which you succinctly put into settler colonialism was a pan-European project containing this germ of whiteness. So really just building on what you were saying, from going to 2020 to one of your previous books with Bacon's Rebellion, when you're talking about class collaboration, you really bring this timeline into a longer narrative. And I was wondering if you could speak more about this misconception of Virginia being the seedbed of settler colonialism, which I think you've already spoken to, but to break it open more.
Well, yeah. I mean, because basically, if you look at North America, I mean, it's obvious that the Spanish created a settlement in St. Augustine, Florida in 1565. St. Augustine, Florida still exists. If you look at my footnotes, you'll see that I did quite a bit of research at the St. Augustine Historical Society. I recommend St. Augustine, Florida. It's right on the Atlantic Ocean. It's very scenic. You have buildings, including a slave market that's still in existence from the bad old days, for example. You still have these very narrow streets and ancient architecture. But in any case, it's clear that Florida is the origin of settler colonialism in the United States of America. And indeed, when the English sail into what they call Virginia in 1607, named after the so-called Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth, that the Spanish, from their perch in St. Augustine, want to stop them, but they're too busy fighting the indigenous population and their African allies. And so they're tied down. So one of the reasons why we're sitting here speaking English as a result of the successful venture of the English in 1607 is because the Africans and the indigenous in Florida were so adept at battling the Spanish. And then, of course, if you look across the continent at the U.S. state we now refer to as New Mexico, it was about 30 years after St. Augustine that the Spanish conquistadors began moving north from New Spain, or Mexico, as we now call it, Mexico City in particular, to settle, to use that euphemism, New Mexico. And what's interesting about that, to connect it to our previous discussion, is that it's suspected that the conquistadors who invaded what we now call New Mexico were probably of Jewish origins, but they were passing. They were actually so-called New Christians. And indeed, I quote a New York Times article from about, I think it's 2019, of folk in New Mexico to this very day who, in the nighttime, when they're at home and the doors are shut and the shutters are pulled down, they engage in these rituals, which we would call Jewish rituals, and they're not even sure why they're doing it. It's just sort of folklore passed down from generation to generation. But I think it's fair to infer that this is an expression of this new Christian phenomenon. The new Christians played a pivotal role with regard to this new era that was opening with Columbus's voyage. As noted, some of them might have been on the ships with Columbus. They played a pivotal role because many of them were expelled to Africa, for example, from the Iberian Peninsula, and many of them became cartographers or map makers in Africa and drew up maps that proved to be essential when the moment arrived for the Western Europeans to sail into Africa to take Africans and transport them across the Atlantic to be enslaved. So I like Theodore Allen's book. I recommend it, The Invention of the White Race, volumes 1 and 2. But I think that in focusing on Virginia, which I understand, I guess what you could say is that Virginia carries the roots of Anglo settler colonialism, to be more precise. Mm-hmm. It's just like the New York Times 1619 Project. Mm-hmm. Where the idea was put forward that August 1619 marks the date when enslaved Africans were brought to Virginia, when in fact, as my book suggests, in the 1520s, from their perch in Santo Domingo, the Spanish brought enslaved Africans to the area north of Florida, but the enslaved Africans rebelled, joined the indigenous comrades, and sent the Spanish fleeing and packing back to the Caribbean. So sometimes there's a sort of making an equivalent of settler colonialism and Anglo-settler colonialism, when actually we're talking about two distinct phenomena. It was the Spanish who were the pioneers.
Yeah, that's a good distinction. I guess Allen was looking at really the legislation that was putting white into it in Virginia. And going back to St. Augustine, you were saying that Spain's defeat on August 7th, 1588,
was, would you say, the origins of the USA because of that defeat they had suffered. I was really interested in your book about Jacques de Soares, and when you talk about how he struck fear into Menendez de Avilés, who you say is the founding father of settler colonialism in the U.S., mm-hmm. and it kind of reminded me of Jefferson's fear after Louis Vuitton in Haiti, and kind of the same fear that was struck into Menendez. But I was wondering if you could speak, kind of tell more of the story on Soria or Jacques de Soares, who you refer to as John Brown of the Pan-Caribbean.
Well, it's a very interesting story. I mean, so you have all this contestation, particularly between the English, the Spanish, the Portuguese, and the French. And then you have contradictions and splits amongst those groups. For example, you have splits between French Catholics and French Protestants. For example, the French Protestants known as the Huguenots. And to make a long story short, what happens is that the Huguenots, the French Protestants, try to gain an advantage over their French Catholic competitors and over other European competitors by cutting deals with enslaved Africans who are under the jurisdiction of Spain, for example. And so Jacques de Soares, or de Soria, and you can check my book for the different spellings of his name if you're mm-hmm. interested in gaining more information about him. He was a French Protestant mariner, or corsair. The Spanish would call him a pirate, who would sail into Spanish territory, including Cuba, by the way, and try to overthrow Spanish rule by promising to give a better deal to the Negroes. And so I have a piece coming out in The Nation, you know, the New York-based publication, in a few weeks, where I talk about Jacques de Soares, Jacques de Soria, is sort of a template for what happened subsequently, because what happened subsequently is that the Africans in South Carolina in 1739, they ally with the Spanish to try to overthrow London settlement in South Carolina and Stono's Revolt, the bloodiest slave revolt in British North America, colonial North America. And then in August 1814, during the War of 1812, when London and the United States were at war, you have the Negroes in Washington, D.C., who ally with the Redcoats and send President James Madison and his garrulous spouse, Dolly, fleeing into the streets. And then they hop on British vessels and flee to Trinidad and Tobago, where their descendants continue to reside. And then returning to Florida, which about 200 years ago becomes U.S. territory, which it remains today. But Britain, like Jacques de Soares, thought it could gain an advantage by cutting favorable deals with the enslaved population under U.S. rule. So in northern Florida, as the U.S. is about to take over, the British helped to establish what's called the Negro Fort, where you had is one of the most well-armed encampments of black people in North America, making the Black Panther Party of the 20th century seem tame by comparison. And indeed, Andrew Jackson, the favorite president of the 45th U.S. president, Mr. Trump, he gains his reputation by waging war against the Negro Fort, which was eventually liquidated. And so by talking about Jacques de Soares, he begins an example, and then it continues in the 20th century with many black people aligning with Japan, as I talk about in my book, Facing the Rising Sun. Many black people aligning with Moscow during the Cold War, as discussed in my book, Paul Robeson, W.B. Du Bois. I wrote a number of books on that subject. Mm-hmm. So the issue being that even for the oppressors, it's dangerous to engage in oppression because the oppressed will cut a deal with your antagonist and seek to overthrow you. And I think that that lesson has not been learned sufficiently by the U.S. ruling class, which is not necessarily renowned for its political intelligence and its political acumen. So that's one of the reasons I've spent so much time in the 16th century book talking about this French corsair. And speaking of the Protestants and the Catholics in France, that illustrates another theme of this book that's still relevant, because there was murderous war between the French Protestants and the French Catholics, culminating in the early 1570s with St. Bartholomew's Massacre, when the Catholics invited the Protestants to meetings all over France and then fell upon them and massacred them by the thousands in Rwanda-style genocide. Now, what's interesting, number one, is that this kind of approach was oftentimes used against Native Americans. Actually, it was also used against Toussaint Louverture in Haiti when he was captured in 1802 when he was fighting the French invaders. They had invited him to a meeting, and then they arrested him. sent him into exile in Europe, where he died. And, of course, it was oftentimes the settlers in North America, they invite Native American leaders to a meeting and then fall upon them and massacre them all. What's interesting, of course, is that that particular strategy has echoed in what one set of Europeans did to another set of Europeans. But as noted, that kind of antagonism between and amongst Europeans began to dissipate as they crossed the Atlantic and decided that the better part of wisdom was to rebrand themselves as quote white unquote and to unite under one umbrella so as to better combat the indigenous, who of course are many different ethnic groups. Just speaking of my part of North America, the Kiowas, the Comanches, the Lipa and Apaches, the Arapaho in your part of North America, the Caddos, I mean, the Cherokees were forced to evacuate from Georgia to Oklahoma during the Trail of Tears. And so the Europeans, they unite under this one umbrella of whiteness, even though before they were split between French Protestants, French Catholics, English versus Irish, English versus Scots, British versus German, German versus Pole, Pole versus Russian, Serb versus Croat, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian. Once they cross the Atlantic, they're all united under one identity politics, militarized identity politics is what I call it. And it's quite a story. And then you mentioned Lepanto, L-E-P-A-N-T-O.
Yes.
This is a pivotal war. Because recall that just a few moments ago, we were discussing the ascendancy of the Muslims, particularly the Ottoman Turks, and how it was that they began to be eclipsed. And part of the reason that they were eclipsed was because of Lepanto. This where the Catholics in particular unite in the early 1570s to inflict a stinging defeat upon them. But also, London, one of the reasons we're speaking English today is that London cuts deals with the Ottoman Turks against the Spanish Catholics in particular, who they see as the more formidable foe. And I think the Ottoman Turks underestimate London. And in fact, in the 1530s, when Henry VIII, as noted, expels the Catholics and liquidates a goodly number of them, as I say in the book, on one day, you see these monks and Catholic rogues walking the streets of London. The next day, they're gone. They're liquidated. Get out of here. And then what happens is that Henry VIII sends a good deal of the wealth expropriated from the Catholics to Ottoman Turkey to solidify the alliance against the Catholics. And so over the last 500 years, you've had this story of the decline of the Muslim power that was Ottoman Turkey that culminates, of course, in 1918 when they're on the losing side during World War I, But you may have noticed that with the rise of I'm not going to draw an equivalence between the forces I'm about to mention and Ottoman Turkey, but as noted, it's unavoidable that today you have the rise of the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda. From their point of view and their way of thinking, they feel that they're trying to revive and relive the glory days of Ottoman Turkey. And certainly, if you look at the African continent, which has some of the weakest political structures on this small planet, they're making significant gains in northern Nigeria, the Sahel region, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Chad, even in Mozambique. So that's something to keep your eye on.
Yeah, and speaking of that, this new report just came out by The Intercept as well about these CIA-backed Afghan death squads that even have been accused of massacring children in Afghanistan.
Well, what's interesting about that is that the International Criminal Court in The Hague just a few months ago opened a case against the United States to investigate the United States for war crimes in Afghanistan. And so what happens is that the U.S., per Secretary of State Michael Pompeo, immediately slapped sanctions on leaders of the International Criminal Court, including the chief prosecutor, the Gambian barrister Fatou Bensouda. And the United States' reach was so extensive that it not only froze her bank accounts, although she doesn't live in the United States, it froze the bank accounts of many of her relatives. And so the United States takes this idea of being investigated for war crimes. For some reason, they take that very seriously.
Just like when they pulled out when they were accused in the 80s with Nicaragua.
Oh, mining the harbors.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely.
Well, thank you for going into all those topics. I was really interested in Amador, and you spoke about him. You said, quote, who should be seen as part of the pantheon that includes Nat Turner and Hutui mm-hmm. of Cuba, and mm-hmm. They slaughtered Europeans in churches, including priests, and an army of thousands under his leadership destroyed virtually all of the despised sugar mills.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. there's, as some may have inferred from my remarks thus far, there is a critique in this book of the bloodier aspects of organized religion, particularly Christianity. And that helps to shed light upon Amador because, of course, as you know, I did some books on Hawaii some years ago, yeah, the White Pacific, and then Fighting in Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And the indigenous Hawaiians, at least many of them, part of their folklore is that in the 19th century, the European and Euro-American missionaries began to arrive, and we had some land, and they had the Bible. But it wasn't long before we were missionized, and we had the Bible, and they had the land. And so, obviously, there is a critique to be made of the bloodier aspects of settler colonialism and of colonialism itself, because Amador, for example, what he was fighting was taking place in Africa itself, actually in Sao Tome and Principe, to be more precise. And what was happening is that in the late 1500s, the Europeans were trying to establish these sugar plantations in Sao Tome and Principe, and then in having enslaved African labor from Africa to work that land. But then Amador rose up and began to lead an army of thousands to chase them out. And at that point, you begin to see the Portuguese in particular begin to focus on Brazil. They say, you know what? Maybe we should just cross the Atlantic, set up our sugar plantations in Brazil, and then drag the Africans further away from the African continent as opposed to enslaving Africans on their own soil. and of course, there's an analog to the indigenous population, because even though there was an enslavement process of the indigenous population, oftentimes in the Americas, they were liquidated or they were shipped out to be enslaved in the slave markets of Ottoman Turkey, Algeria, or even the Caribbean. And then Africans were brought over from the Atlantic to be the major bulk of the enslaved labor force. And so Amador, as noted, needs to be celebrated because he helped to rescue Africa from an even more horrible fate than befell it. And let me also say that with regard to that comment you made about how he was attacking the missionaries, that there is this New Zealand film that I recommend. I think it's on YouTube, although I'm sure you can find it. It's called Utu, U-T-U. And it's about the Europeans or the British invading what they call New Zealand in the middle of the 19th century. And the Maoris, who are expert fighters, that's one of the reasons why New Zealand today is more progressive than Australia across the Tasman, because the Maoris were expert fighters. I'm afraid to say more adept than their peers and counterparts across the Tasman in the indigenous Australians. So there's a scene from Utu where this indigenous leader, he comes into this church where the Europeans are trying to missionize, as they say, the indigenous population. And the indigenous population is sitting in the pews, and the leader, he marches up to the pulpit, takes out a hatchet, and attacks the missionary. It's a remarkable scene.
Oh, wow. So check out that film.
Oh, yeah. Check it out. You too. You too. You. As a matter of fact, let me digress. Let me pass it on. I used to be, you know, I've done books in film history, and so for the longest, I've been watching various films. And I also would recommend in that regard The Chanting of Jimmy Blacksmith. It's an Australian film about indigenous resistance in Australia, The Chanting of Jimmy Blacksmith. I would also recommend The Killing of Angel Street. It's another Australian film. It deals with more contemporary Australia, but a class struggle in Australia. And let's see, what I probably could think of a few more, but those are the ones that come to mind immediately.
Okay, awesome. I'll check those out. Yeah, I love your book on Hollywood as well.
Oh, good.
Along with Amador, I was really interested in, you talk about 1522, that there was a large-scale uprising during the Christmas holiday where a sugar mill belonging to the son of Columbus and his comrades was burned down. And also, was this revolt led by a man named McGill, or
well,
was it a different revolt?
Yeah, that's a different revolt.
Okay.
But you know, I know where I talk about so many revolts in that book that I understand why they all sort of run together. But what's interesting about that revolt is that it's replicated. If you were to do a typology of slave revolts, one of the things you would find is they often take place around this time of year. Hint, hint. That is to say, during the so-called Christmas holiday, when there was this feeling that the settlers would be inebriated, distracted, celebrating, and the oppressed would seize that opportunity to rise up. I mean, that happens not only in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. It's quite remarkable.
Oh, wow. Thanks for sharing that and breaking open that history on those revolts. Speaking of revolts and internationalism, I wanted to ask you about May 25th, 2020, when George Floyd was murdered. You saw this internationalism with people protesting at U.S. embassies. I believe African nations sought a U.N. inquiry into U.S. racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk about this internationalism, where we are at right now with the fight against global white supremacy.
Well, it's interesting that the United Nations Human Rights Council investigation is ongoing, in fact. And it walks in the footsteps of previous efforts, such as the effort spearheaded by the late, great Paul Robeson in 1950, when he and an organization now defunct called the Civil Rights Congress file a petition to the United Nations charging the United States with genocide against black people. You can still find the book, We Charge Genocide, at various libraries or perhaps on various sites to buy, if that is your interest. And then in 1978, there was another effort that led by the National Conference of Black Lawyers. As a young lawyer, I was part of that effort to file a similar sort of petition against the United States at the highest bodies of the United Nations. And as you suggest, after May 25th, 2020, with the lynching on camera of George Floyd, there was quite a remarkable display of international solidarity with the Black American community in Australia, New Zealand, and London, and Berlin, and elsewhere. And we really need organizational forms, strengthened organizational forms, to capitalize on that kind of solidarity, because one of the themes of my work has been the importance of international solidarity in propelling struggle forward in these United States of America, because class collaboration has been so potent. It reminds me, it's like the silent gas that kills. I mean, it's potent, but it's oftentimes not seen or perceived. It's like you see these stories occasionally in the newspaper about how a person will leave their car running in the garage, and then it's carbon monoxide, escapes, and kills the family and such. Well, obviously the family is not aware of this gas that's killing them. And that's how class collaboration works. It's oftentimes not visible to the naked eye. It's almost like it's normalized. You know, reference the comment I just made about David Duke, a Nazi, getting 55% of the Euro-American vote in 1991 for governor of Louisiana. And that was a clear example of class collaboration, but it was not necessarily problematized in that sense. And so because of the potency of this class collaboration, it makes all the more important our attempt to forge global solidarity, which is even more possible now given the rise of the internet, and you can find out what's happening at any corner of the world. You can communicate over email, text, various other platforms, as they say. So international solidarity has never been more possible. The only question is, are we in a position to execute?
I was really grateful for your research on digging into Sir Francis Drake and John Hawkins. A lot of times they're very glanced over. When I went through my K-12, I actually didn't even learn about them. And I think when I learned about Sir Francis Drake, it was nothing of showing him being the monster he was. I had heard about John Hawkins through RZA, ironically, through listening to an old Gravedigger song called The Night the Earth Cried. And he spoke about separated to portions and tricked by John Hattie Hawkins. That was a bar in his song, which actually made me look into him in middle school. But your work really broke open these two figures and showed really for what they were as being pirates and thieves. And I wonder if you had anything to add on things not known about them.
Is that Sir Francis Drake is considered a hero. I remember when I was doing research in San Francisco. In San Francisco, California, there's still a number of buildings and hotels named after Sir Francis Drake. It would be, I find it very interesting that, understandably and justifiably, there is an effort in the United States to remove the name of Columbus from various buildings and schools, et cetera. But Sir Francis Drake has gotten a pass so far, and I underline so far. And Sir Francis Drake and his comrade John Hawkins, they are a major reason why we're sitting here in North America communicating in English, because basically he was a parasite upon a parasite. What I mean is a lot of the early wealth in London under Queen Elizabeth was built by the piracy of Sir Francis Drake, who would raid Spanish ships groaning with wealth looted from the Incas of today's Peru and the Aztecs of today's Mexico. And as these ships were crossing the Atlantic, Sir Francis Drake's ships would come out of nowhere and then board the Spanish ships, take all the wealth, kill all the people, and then eventually transfer all that wealth to London. That's what I mean about being parasites upon parasites. The Spanish are the parasites acting parasitically upon the indigenous Incas and Aztecs. And then Sir Francis Drake would then loot from them, speaking of the Spanish. And that's how London got in the passing lane, by basically being a parasite upon a parasite. And of course, I'll leave it to the political psychologists to wonder if the lineal descendants of Anglo culture still reflects that parasitical nature of being parasites upon parasites, which may be the worst parasites of all.
That's way well put. For my last question, I wanted to talk to you about some of the newer projects you're working on. I had read that you were working on or toying with the new idea of U.S. 19th century wielding ancient history. And I was wondering if that was in reference to David Walker. Oh, I think I read it on NYU Press.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. I thought I just thought of that. Maybe I thought about that earlier. So, yeah, I have this project. So it's about, it's going to deal with that. That is to say, you know, the U.S. Negroes in the 19th century, they were always being told that they were inferior. And so they would then point to ancient Egypt, and particularly the role of the Nubians, N-U-B-I-A-N-S. In that part of Africa, not only in today's Sudan, but heading north into Egypt, which was an advanced civilization, obviously, which bequeathed a lot of knowledge to ancient Greece, for example, which is thought to be the seedbed of a good deal of so-called European civilization. So I was going to explore that historically and also look at U.S. relations with Egypt. Because and also look at the whole phenomenon of the Egyptology, which is this sort of archaeology and unearthing ancient Egyptian civilization, which, of course, was originally spearheaded by Napoleon in the late 18th century, and then the torch was passed to the English. That is to say, these countries that think that they're part of an advanced civilization, inevitably, they get involved in Egyptology because, of course, eventually the torch was passed to the United States. John D. Rockefeller became a devotee of Egyptology, for example, of sponsoring many digs in ancient Egypt. So I'm going to deal with that, and I'm going to deal with U.S. diplomatic relations with Egypt during the 19th century and, you know, the political developments in Egypt. Which then, you know, this Black American fascination with Egypt continues in the 20th century with regard to these philosophies of Afrocentrism, Afrocentrism, and also a large expatriate Black American population in Egypt. And then, this is why you do research. I just found out, because I'm doing also this project on Texas and 19th century Texas, which, of course, secedes from Mexico. And part of the story involves, during the U.S. Civil War, France takes over Mexico. That's where the holiday Cinco de Mayo comes from, if you'll recall.
And so what happens?
Sorry? Exactly, under Maximilian. And so what happens is that the French, who by that time have a foothold in Africa, they dispatch Sudanese troops to fight along French troops against the great Mexican national hero, Benito Juarez. Of course, you know about Ciudad Juarez, just across from El Paso, Texas, or you may know the movie from the 1930s about Juarez, and where he's not played by a Mexican, he's played by Paul Muni, who's of Eastern European descent, but that's another story. So I'm finding out more and more. So that's another, here's another project I'm working on, since I'm, it's always fun to talk about stuff you haven't done. And that is, I started off wanting to do a project about for James Brooke. I write about him in my book, Race War, because he and his family take over a part of what is now Indonesia and rule it like an apartheid fiefdom for about 100 years until the Japanese invade in the 1940s. So I still might do that, but, you know, the archives are all locked down now because of the pandemic. So I've just been reading dissertations, and I haven't been able to find enough dissertations and master's thesis about this. So now I'm sort of expanding it to look at Southeast Asia and look at Malaya. Because as you know, after World War II, the British squash a communist-led insurgency in what is now Malaysia, then called Malaya. And the United States, and also the French, when they're fighting in Vietnam, they look to the British effort in Malaya as sort of a template as to how you squash insurgencies. And what's interesting is that the insurgency in Malaya is spearheaded by the Communist Party, which is heavily Chinese. And the same holds true for the Communist Party in Indonesia post-World War II, which is heavily Chinese. And so you may know that in 1965, the U.S. aligns with the Indonesian military to execute a decapitation of the Indonesian Communist Party. And I should also say that a decapitation of the business community, the national bourgeoisie of Indonesia, which is heavily Chinese too. And it's really a signal event of the 20th century. And so I wrote a piece that you can now find in the journal Diplomatic History, where I talk about the insurgency in Malaya, the anti-Chinese element of that, the insurgency, the decapitation of the Indonesian Communist Party, and what impact that might have had on the People's Republic of China. Because it's estimated that 500,000 people were killed. It was like Rwanda. I mean, it's 500,000 people killed in a matter of weeks, mostly of Chinese ancestry. And I speculate what impact that might have had upon the Chinese Communist Party. So I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, wow. I have to look up that piece.
Okay, thank you, and good luck to you.
Okay. Thank you, Gerald. Have a good day.
All right, bye-bye. Okay.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Time Talks podcast, part of the Channel Zero Network. Please support Dr. Horn's work. Links to his books are in the show notes. Thank you to Awareness for the music. Please support this podcast on Patreon or share it around, and check out other Channel Zero Network podcasts.